All right. Good morning, everybody. It is hard to believe that we are in the first Wednesday in June, but then again, we are in very unusual times, as everybody knows. Before I get to some COVID stuff, I wanted to bring to your attention some, at least those of you, and I think most of you out there do business in Maryland, some laws that are going to affect the workplace come October the 1st. As you may or may not know, the 2020 Maryland legislative session ended on May the 7th, and there were a number of bills that will become law because Governor Hogan either signed or allowed them to be passed without a signature on that date. And some of these will directly affect all of you who do business in Maryland as they apply to the workplace. The following will take place or be effective as of October the 1st. So not that far away, and I wanted to bring these to your attention. First, the General Assembly passed a modification to the state's anti-discrimination law, which will prohibit employment discrimination based on certain traits, such as hairstyle and hair texture associated with race. So specifically, the new statute will prohibit discrimination on the basis of a, in quotes, protective hairstyle, close quotes, which includes braids, twists, and locks, and clarifies that the definition of race will also include traits associated with race, including hair texture, Afro hairstyles, and protective hairstyles. So with this modification, Maryland joins six other states, including, by the way, neighboring Virginia, to enact this similar kind of protected classification. Second, as of October 1st, those of you who have laid off employees during the COVID-related crisis know that while there is has been historically a federal WARN Act, there really wasn't a mini WARN Act in Maryland that was mandatory. There was one that was voluntary. That will change on October the 1st so that the General Assembly, as I indicated in May, amended Maryland's Economic Stabilization Act, which is also known as the Mini WARN Act. And that has certain requirements to it. And the reason I certainly bring this to your attention is as we go further into the year where you may have further layoffs as a result of a second wave of COVID-related incidents, I wanted to make sure that you understand what this amended law will do. So covered employers are those employers in the state of Maryland with at least 50 employees. And, excuse me, what it'll require, similar to the Federal WARN Act, is 60 days written notice of certain information that you'll have to provide to the employee. And that includes the name and address of the workplace where the reduction of operations is expected to occur, the name, telephone number, and email address of a supervisory employee who may be contacted for further information, and a statement that explains whether the reduction in operations is expected to be permanent or temporary. So these are similar to those requirements which are found in the Federal WARN Act. And as I stated, up until now, there weren't really mandatory requirements in Maryland regarding WARN Act kinds of protections. Now there will be as of October the 1st. And as I indicated, as we go further into the year, and if you are in a situation where you believe that there may be mass layoffs, particularly as a result of COVID or a second wave of COVID, you need to pay attention to these requirements. And if there are issues, then certainly you can get back in touch with me. The last thing that I'll mention is that the General Assembly amended Maryland's Equal Pay Act. And under this amendment, it creates several new employer obligations and protections for employees along the following. First of all, it requires an employer to provide the wage range for the position in question upon the applicant's request. So if you have an applicant for a new position and that applicant requests what the wage range is, you have to provide that to him or her. Second, it prohibits you as an employer from asking about or seeking that applicant's wage history, either orally or in writing, through the employee or an agent of the employee, which would be a headhunter probably, or from a current or former employer. And it also prohibits you as an employer from retaliating against or refusing to interview, hire, or employ an applicant because that applicant requested the wage range for the position in question or chose not to provide his or her wage history. Now, I think the practical impact of this, of these three things, even though these technically don't go into effect until October 1st, is that you need to take a look at your handbooks and policies. And if I were you, I would think carefully about amending these well ahead of October 1st and distributing them so that when October 1st comes, you'll be in compliance with these new Maryland statutes. They really haven't gotten a lot of play, to the best of my knowledge, in any kind of publication. And I think that that's largely because of all the attention that's been paid on all the COVID-related situations and information from the beginning of March till actually the present date. So pay attention to that. And if you need some help on your policies and procedures, be happy to help out if you want to reach me. All right, let me go into something that was published on May the 27th, just a week ago. And you can find this on the CDC's website, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention website, because it is a comprehensive guide to employer information for office buildings. Those of you, many of you out there are working remotely. I know, as I've indicated, the attorneys in our firm are for the most part working remotely as well. The CDC website has a very, very comprehensive guide on those issues that you'll need to pay attention to in reopening your office space or buildings along any kind of phased reopening that you're contemplating. And while I'm not going to read everything, obviously, on this particular website, I want to point out certain highlights, which I think are well worth emphasizing. And again, you can find this. It's very easy to find. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention website is entitled COVID-19 Employer Information for Office Buildings. So let me get into some of the highlights. First, they say before resuming business operations, check the building to see if it's ready for occupancy. And along those lines, they indicate evaluate the building and its mechanical and life safety systems to determine if the building is ready for occupancy. Check for hazards associated with prolonged facility shutdown, such as mold growth, rodents or pests, and issues with significant water systems, and take appropriate remedial actions. Secondly, identify where and how workers might be exposed to COVID-19 at work. So they indicate conduct a thorough hazard assessment of the workplace to identify potential workplace hazards that could increase risk for COVID-19 transmission. They indicate that you should identify work in common areas where employees could have close contact within 6 feet of others. For example, meeting rooms, break rooms, cafeteria, locker rooms, check-in areas, waiting areas, and routes of entry and exit. Third, engineering controls isolate workers from the hazard. So they talk about modifying or adjusting seats, furniture, and workstations to maintain social distancing of 6 feet between employees. For some of you out there, that may not be so easy, but there are technical guides in this particular website to do that. Next, they talk about using methods to physically separate employees in all areas of the facilities, including work areas and other areas such as meeting rooms, break rooms, parking lots, entrance and exit areas, and locker rooms. They have a whole section which is entitled Administrative Controls Change the Way People Work, which I believe is a very significant title. Changing the way people work is going to be something that we all need to take a look at. So they outline employees who appear to have symptoms upon arrival at work or who become sick during the day should immediately be separated from others, provided a face mask if they are not using one, and sent home with instructions and guidance on how to follow up with their healthcare professional. Secondly, consider conducting daily in-person or virtual health checks. That is, symptoms and or temperature screening of employees before they enter work. They also can talk about considering staggering shifts, start times, and break times as feasible to reduce the density of employees in common areas, such as screening areas, break rooms, and locker rooms. And they have a whole section on cleaning and disinfecting high-touch surfaces, providing employees adequate time to wash their hands, establish policies and practices for social distancing. They have a whole provision and section on educating employees and supervisors about steps they can take to protect themselves at work, and very significantly, communicating with employees regarding your policies, which I think is critical. I think that you ought to be contemplating, if you haven't done already, communicating to your workforce those steps that will be implemented to protect them, and on the flip side of that coin, which they will be expected to follow for purposes of COVID-related protection. And that's very important. Now, also in this website, they provide links to additional resources, including OSHA, as well as the American Industrial Hygiene Association's guidance for general office settings and building owners and managers association. So this is a very, very worthwhile website that you should pay some attention to as you contemplate or as you are already implementing a return to work policy and procedure. Related to all the COVID things, I know that some of you may have faced or may face those employees who say that they are reluctant to return to work because they have concerns about whether it will be safe or not. And I think that this falls into the category of, while not being necessarily required, because the fear of returning to work doesn't constitute in and of itself a disability under the ADA, it may nevertheless be prudent to have an interactive dialogue with that particular employee as to why that employee may have concerns about returning to work, and for you to document that dialogue and what your advice is or what the employee's concerns are. Keep in mind that if the employee does have a compromised immune system, that in itself may constitute a disability under the ADA, which may cause you to have an interactive dialogue about accommodations, which could include, of course, a temporary modification of a work schedule, temporary job restructuring, a leave of absence, or the ability to work remotely. We are in a very sort of crisis situation when employees will have a variety of concerns, and you may have to deal with them on an individualized basis. Also, keep in mind that under the National Labor Relations Act, employees have the right to engage in protected concerted activity, which means, of course, that if you have two or more employees who are expressing concerns, certainly that may be protected activity under Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act and may cause you to have some pause or concern prior to taking any negative action or retaliatory action against that employee or groups of employees for expressing those concerns. And I think that we'll see further actions by employees or employees' attorneys who are claiming protection under the National Labor Relations Act as we go forward, as we will see, I think, more legal actions against companies, whether it's related to the ADA, whether it's related to the National Labor Relations Act, or OSHA, because, as you know, under OSHA, employers have the obligation to provide a safe and reasonably safe workplace. So I think we will see a spate of employee claims going forward as to whether or not they perceive the employer's workplace as being safe and adequate for their protection under the law. I wanted to mention also that as you continue to engage in a remote working environment, it may pose challenges for workplace investigations. Those of you out there who have responsibility for conducting workplace investigations know that, of course, as an integral part of any investigation, you're going to want to interview certainly the complaining witness and any possible witnesses who may have information about the particular complaint. Well, if you are in a remote working environment, that of course poses challenges, but not insurmountable challenges. Thus, with various platforms, whether it's WebEx, whether it's Zoom, Microsoft Teams, etc., there's nothing in the law that would preclude conducting workplace investigations in a remote way. Of course, that assumes that either the complaining party or witnesses would have internet access and be able to access whatever platform you are using. But the mere fact that you're conducting it remotely does not mean that the investigation would be any more invalid than if you were conducting it in person. And certainly, in some respects, it may be even easier to do it remotely than it is face-to-face, assuming that you have good platforms for doing so. One of the things that I know that most platforms provide for is a recording of whatever interviews or discussions that you would have. Of course, you would not be able to do this, particularly in Maryland, without the consent of the person that you are interviewing. But you will have that technical capability. And if you were doing that kind of a interview, I certainly would suggest that in order to preserve, whatever testimony you have, it would be a good thing to at least attempt to get that consent from the complaining party or witnesses. Naturally, if there's an objection, you wouldn't go ahead and record it without such consent. So I know that we are in uncharted territory when it comes to this kind of thing, but I just wanted to mention to you that you have the right to conduct investigations. Certainly, I think in most cases, you want to conduct those investigations, even if you are working remotely, because you simply cannot put off relevant investigations, if you're working remotely, to the time that you'll be face to face, because memories fade, and you certainly want, from a legal standpoint, to be able to document what you did in relation to a particular complaint. So the mere fact, again, that you're going to do it remotely is not a reduction in the credibility of that particular investigation or an excuse not to conduct the investigation. Okay. Anyway, those are the developments for the day. Casey, can you take this off of mute, please? All right. As I always do, I will throw it open to any questions or concerns anybody has. It is a very, very challenging time for all of you out there with any kind of labor or HR duties or responsibilities, because there are many questions, the answers to which are in the gray area, not black and white. Okay, any questions, concerns?
Howard, this is Ann.
Yeah.
I had a question about the amended Economic Stabilization Act.
Yes.
When it says 50 employees minimum, we've kind of gone up and down this year with some layoffs and so forth. What's the general rule in figuring whether, like, what period of time you're averaging?
There will be a specific time period in the statute itself, and okay, much like under the CARES Act or whatever. And I probably should have said that it wouldn't surprise me that between now and October the 1st, there will be enabling regulations that are promulgated and published by the appropriate or applicable departments, most likely the Department of Labor for that particular statute. I'll keep an eye out on it, and as we get closer, I'll probably have more to say about any of these three statutes, but there will be, I think, regulations which will pinpoint the look-back period on determining the number of employees.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Howard, this is the other Ann. Do you
think
that the state of Maryland will adopt the federal Warren Act measures, the look backs, the how do you count part-time employees, et cetera?
I do.
Not new yet?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do think that they will, in many cases, use that as the template, and as they do in many cases.
Right. Many states do that. Mm-hmm.
You know, the problem with a lot of these statutes that were passed as of May the 7th, the end of the legislative session, is that they were passed in the context of a crisis. And even under the best of circumstances, my take on the Maryland legislature when it comes to contemplating and being clear with regard to what the language says in statutes is not exactly exemplary. And here we had things that were really rushed through at the last minute during the COVID-related crisis. So I don't have a lot of confidence in the clarity of what these things say. But again, I'll be taking a look at these between now and October 1st. But I do think you're right, Ann. In many cases, what the law is under the federal statute will probably be applicable to the state as well.
Yeah, that would certainly be helpful for us to work a multi- Right.
Thank you. Sure, I'll pay attention to it. Any other questions?
Yeah, I had a question about the wage and hour law. If we have a field on our employment application online that is a voluntary salary, you know, what is your current salary? Do you think that's a violation of the new law?
Yes, I think that you will not be able to do that because I think taking the position that it was voluntary, in my opinion, will not be looked upon favorably. If somebody voluntarily discloses it to you in the course of an interview, you know, that's fine. But just saying to somebody that it's voluntary, I don't think, given the Maryland law, is going to take you out of the prohibitions under the law.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
I have a related question. Do you think it's okay to ask what salary range the applicant is looking for or requesting as opposed to their current salary?
Well, remember, under the new statute, they can ask what the salary range is, and you're expected to provide it. So I think that that would be permissible, as long as you're not asking, you know, what their past salary history is.
Exactly. Great. Thank you.
Sure. Any other questions?
Yeah, Howard. This is Randall Singer. How are you?
Hey, Randall.
Related to the same topic, do you expect like additional guidance or regulations around that, or we're gonna sort of change our practices and change maybe our interview training based just on the statute?
No, I think Randall, that there will be additional guidance and or regulations. Probably, if I had to bet, maybe more so guidance, like frequently asked questions, which is what they usually do ahead of regulations, because the regulations take on sort of the rule of law. Frequently asked questions are their way of sort of a middle ground. So I would think that there will be frequently asked questions ahead of the regulations. Anything else? Okay. Well, if not, look, it's been a rough 3 months, I know, for everyone out there. And, you know, if I had to bet, I don't think that the next 3 months are going to be all that much easier. So I sympathize with all of you. As always, I indicate that if you have questions that you would prefer to deal with, or if you have policy changes that need another eye to take a look at, feel free to get in touch with me. We're doing a bunch of policy modifications within our labor and employment department. So I hope everybody stays well and safe and healthy, and that your employees do the same, because we are not out of the woods yet, that's for sure. So take
care,
everybody.
Sure.
Have a good day.
Thank you so much, Howard.
Okay. All take right. care.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You.
Thank you.
Bye.